Okay, I once heard a joke. What is red and black and covers the ground in November? Poppies, right? Yeah. Well, not if you follow the tips on that video. Yeah, thank you. Yep. Well, just as a poppy tends to fall off so easily, if we aren't intentional about securing it on our lapels, like suggested in the video, I would suggest that so too are our intentions to be people who pursue peace. Unless we are intentional and determined about our efforts to be peacemakers, that mindset can really easily just disappear, like a poppy. So as John has mentioned, today is Peace Sunday, where Anabaptist churches like us take time to reflect on the message of peace that was taught and modeled by Jesus Christ. It's a challenging message, because for followers of Jesus Christ, the pursuit of peace is not just an annual event like Peace Sunday or Remembrance Day. Pursuing peace is supposed to be an ordinary, everyday part of who we are thing, encompassing everything that we do, from how we interact with our families, to how we treat people who are mean to us, to what kind of entertainment we choose. But it often doesn't stick. We recall that pursuing peace is one of the 10 core values of the BIC Church, and that value states, we value all human life and promote forgiveness, understanding, reconciliation, and nonviolent resolution of conflict. Now, when people hear that we are a peace church, they automatically think about war and conscientious objectors, as John has talked about. And those are really important, valid questions, but they only scratch the surface of what pursuing peace is all about. We are in the thick of our You Have Heard It Said series based on Matthew 5, where Jesus has challenged his audience to look beyond the law and beyond the usual way of doing things and to see and embrace the heart of God. So let's turn to Matthew 5 right now, and we're going to read verses 38 to 42. Jesus says, you have heard that it was said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. So this passage challenges us to expand our understanding of what it means to pursue peace. So Jesus starts out with, you've heard it said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. So first, Jesus defines the traditional view of justice, eye for eye and tooth for tooth. Here he's quoting an Old Testament law that may sound pretty harsh to us, but it was actually a way to limit the punishment that could be meted out on someone who had harmed another person. It used to be that if, say, a family member had harmed another person, the offender had to pay back 7 times the amount or suffer 7 times the same offense. So I cause you to lose an eye, I gotta pay back, my family has to pay back 7 eyes. Ouch, yeah. So the eye for an eye law actually served to limit the revenge to this kind of tit for tat equation. And it was an initial step in stopping the escalation of violence. But Jesus teaches here, you've heard it said, that even this limitation doesn't go far enough. He expects his followers to go beyond. Jesus says, you know, you're used to operating like this, Everybody around you is telling you to do things this way, but I'm going to challenge you to go further. You see, pursuing peace entails a choice to do things differently. If you're going to pursue peace, you may have to go against the cultural norm. You may have to approach situations in ways that don't make sense to other people, and they probably won't always feel natural or easy for you. So expect that your striving to become a person of peace may entail a paradigm shift for you and an intentional effort to anchor it. So you've heard it said, eye for eye and tooth for tooth, but I tell you, do not resist an evil person. Now, at first glance, this piece, do not resist an evil person, it may sound like a little bit of passive theology, right? As though Jesus were saying that we should just take whatever comes our way. Allow any kind of bad stuff like aggression or violence or injustice to just happen to us. Just let it happen. That we should just suck it up, just put our tails between our legs and take whatever's dished out. And this is how many people have interpreted that passage. However, I'd like to offer for your consideration, doesn't mean you're going to agree with it, but I'm going to offer for your consideration the teachings of Walter Wink. He's an American theologian, and in particular, I'm going to be basing my comments on an article he wrote called Jesus and Nonviolence, A Third Way. So I found it really helpful in expanding my understanding of what Jesus was teaching here. So, do not resist an evil person. In most Bibles, there's this Greek word that is translated as resist. But in its historical context, it referred to armed military resistance. It meant to resist violently, to resist with lethal force. So, if that's the case, what Jesus actually is saying is something more like, do not violently resist an evildoer. Don't respond to violence with violence. Don't retaliate in kind. The Apostle Paul gets at this idea in Romans 12 when he says, do not repay anyone evil for evil. If your enemies are hungry, feed them. If they're thirsty, give them something to drink. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Now, this understanding of Jesus' words changes the entire tone of the teaching, and it aligns with what comes next. So rather than telling people to passively accept whatever aggression or injustice comes their way, Jesus goes on to give several examples that are specific to his time and culture, of how someone might creatively transform a situation and resist the harm that's being done to them, but without causing harm back to the other person, but also without denying your own right to dignity and justice. Without paying back evil for evil, it's neither fight nor flight, but it's a third way. So here's the first example in verse 39. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. So apparently at that time, people in power could deliver a backhanded slap to their subordinates. Masters could do it to slaves, Romans could do it to Jews, parents could do it to children, but they weren't allowed to use the left hand, right? The left hand was taboo, used for other stuff. It had to be the right hand, and it had to be backhanded. It wasn't meant to injure, it was meant to humiliate or insult. Now, Jolene, come on up here. You're gonna be my volunteer. I need someone shorter than me, even. Yeah, I knew you'd love me. So, if I am trying to insult or humiliate you, I'm gonna strike you on the right cheek with the back of my right hand. Now turn to me your other cheek. look at that. I can't do the same thing again twice, can I? No, because I would have to do it using the front of my hand, which couldn't do, or hit you with my fist. And only equals engaged in fist fights. You can sit down, my dear. Thank you. Yeah. So if by turning your cheek, you are not fighting, you're not fleeing, you are giving this unexpected response. You're looking me in the eye. You're causing me to look you in the eye and see you as a person. You're turning the tables and resisting in a different way. You're saying, I refuse to be humiliated. I'm a human being just like you are. I'm your equal. I'm not your doormat. It would have been a surprising, creative way for an oppressed person to claim their dignity. This is what Walter Wink calls a third way. He's saying, what Jesus is actually saying is stand up for yourself. Stand up for yourself. Assert your humanity. But don't answer the oppressor in kind. Don't slap him back. Find a new third way that is neither cowardly submission nor violent reprisal. We see this same principle in the second example in verse 40. If anyone wants to sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. So in this example, a creditor has taken a poor man to court over an unpaid debt and is suing him for the very clothes on his back. All he's got is the clothes on his back. Most people at that time, the clothes on their back consisted of two garments. There was an outer one made of wool and an inner garment, underclothes, their underwear, made of linen. To sue for the outer garment was allowed, it was lawful, but it was pretty cruel. For the defendant to then turn around and say, take my inner garment too, or take my underwear, as Jesus is suggesting, that would mean that the poor person would be standing there stark naked. Now, nakedness was taboo in Judaism, but it was more shameful for the person viewing the nakedness than it was for the person who was standing there naked. So by giving both his outer and his underclothes, the poor person is turning the tables, right? He's bringing shame on the creditor and shining a light on an unfair system of lending. It's another example of a different creative and nonviolent way of turning the tables on injustice and claiming your humanity. And again, in verse 41, if someone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. So here in context, the Romans were the occupying force, and Roman soldiers could force people to carry their packs for 1 mile, but no more. Couldn't go two, just one. So, someone who's forced to go 1 mile, if he voluntarily takes the pack for a second mile, it kind of upsets the power balance, right? It puts the soldier in contravention of his own law. And when you do more than is asked of you, you're now in control. There's a power shift because you've chosen to do more. And the soldier would be like, what are you doing? He'd be forced to speak to you as an equal. It's a different, creative, nonviolent response. Did you see the point that Jesus was making? Rather than just allowing people to walk all over you or to continue to abuse you, Jesus suggests that his followers transform a situation by doing an unexpected act of asserting their dignity as human beings, calling on the other person to recognize the humanity that they had been treating in an inhumane way. Now, verse 42 addresses a different kind of situation. A lot of commentaries leave this verse out, I find, but here it is. It's there for a reason. It says, give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. Now here, it's you who has the power. Okay? It's you who has the power. But you might be facing people who are wanting to take advantage of you. This happens a lot in Christian circles, okay? There are people who know that this verse is in the Bible and they hope that you will just give indiscriminately because the Bible tells you to. Again, I would suggest that this verse, with all the other ones along with it, helping us interpret it, does not mean that we are to be a doormat, that we should neglect our own needs or the needs of our families, but it does challenge us to go beyond and look at the person who is asking, to look at them with love and compassion and respect. Challenging. And regardless of how much or little we choose to give, you know, we don't lash out at them or treat them unkindly, right? It's too bad that Jesus didn't provide about 20 more examples, right? Since we don't tend towards this kind of response naturally. Some examples from modern history might help anchor this teaching a little bit more securely. These are the grand examples, okay? So during World War II, when Nazis in occupied Denmark ordered all Jews to wear a yellow armband with the Star of David on it, the King of Denmark intentionally attended a celebration in the Jewish synagogue in solidarity with the Jews. Clergy followed suit. The Nazis noticed, and the order was eventually rescinded. And Martin Luther King Jr. suggested that if enough of the population in Germany, which was predominantly Christian, if enough of that population would also have put on those armbands with the yellow stars, it would have been much more difficult, if not impossible, for the Nazis to isolate, round up, and execute the Jews. Creative, non-violent resistance. And in 1986, resisting the racist regime of apartheid, South Africans, black South Africans, launched a boycott. They refused 100% to do any shopping at businesses owned by white people. And within 5 days, a white member of parliament called it the most effective weapon used yet. Creative, nonviolent resistance. And I watched a really helpful documentary. If you want to see more examples, it's called A Force More Powerful, and it's available on YouTube. Lots more examples of stuff like this. But I also want to give a few smaller scale, real life examples of how I have tried to apply this teaching. Because peace is not just out there on the grand scale, it's something we live with every day. So a few years back, I was driving to a wedding in Windsor, unfamiliar territory to me. And I realized that I had bypassed the church. So I pulled into a driveway, and there was a car parked in that driveway. And as I started backing up to turn around, to my horror, that parked car also backed up faster and hit my van. So the driver came out, looked at his damaged bumper. I didn't have any damage. And he yelled, "You are going to pay for this. This is all your fault. You had no business being in my driveway," and other aggressive things. So little old Christian me, pretty intimidated, I said, sorry. Yes, I'll fix it, sir. And I gave him my phone number. And a few days later, he did call me, and still angry, he gave me estimates of the damage, still blaming me for everything and demanding that I pay. So it bothered me. The more I thought it through, the more I felt exploited. I hadn't hit anything. I hadn't failed to look in my rearview mirror, and I checked, there's no law about pulling into a driveway to turn around. But I hesitated to protest because of this very teaching. Do not resist. Turn the other cheek. Didn't this Bible passage mean that I was supposed to accept whatever this angry man demanded, even if I wasn't at fault? Isn't that the Christian approach? Isn't that the way of peace? What kind of witness will I have for the church if I say no? Yeah. Well, I talked to some wise Christian friends, and their words have guided me on numerous occasions in the years that have ensued. Here's what they said. Being a Christian does not mean being a doormat. What it does mean is treating people who oppose you or who are unjust to you or mean to you with respect and fairness. So the challenge then for me was to come up with a respectful way that was fair to approach the angry man. So nothing too dramatic, nothing too creative, but practical. I simply called my insurance company, told them exactly what had happened, and I called the man back and said, you know, I'm really feeling out of my element here. I've opted to let my insurance company handle it for me. I'm really sorry that this all happened, and I hope you get your car fixed. That was it. I spoke with respect, didn't yell at him, didn't assign blame or try to take advantage of him, but I also didn't act like a doormat. One more example. Recently, I was part of an email discussion for a committee that I sit on when one of the other members made some disparaging comments about my son. So, my initial response, peace-loving Christian that I am, I wanted to scratch their eyes out. Like I said, pursuing peace doesn't feel natural. Well, the beauty of email is that you can take some time to respond rather than reacting emotionally. So I took time to calm down. I composed this email using I messages. You know, I feel in conflict of interest. I am uncomfortable being part of this discussion about my son. I will remove myself from this thread so that you can talk more freely. Not terribly creative, but it was a third way. I didn't lash out in rage, but I didn't remain silent either. And what that my email did was it caused the author of those comments to consider the impact of their words on me. And other committee members expressed understanding for my discomfort as a mother. And I could come out of that feeling like I acted with integrity. But then I realized that I hadn't gone far enough. I was also working on this sermon, okay? This was helpful. Go beyond. I needed to still look intentionally at the person as someone created in the image of God, worthy of love and respect and forgiveness, just as I am. And I had to override my natural tendency, which would have been give them the cold shoulder the next meeting, or talk about them behind their back just to make myself feel better. I had to go beyond and treat them kindly in my next interaction with them. I initiated interaction so that I could be kind, and to pray for them. And yes, I have done that. I did it intentionally because it doesn't feel natural. It was like anchoring my poppy. Poppy, yeah. So just as there are ways, as suggested in the video, to anchor our poppies so that they stay on, I wonder if there are ways that we can anchor this Christ-like approach to peace so that it becomes more firmly anchored in us. You know, what can we do as a practice to help us respond in a Jesus-like third way? Are there habits that we can engage in to help us get better at this? What do you do? John did this last week. I found it so effective. What do you do to help you anchor this peace approach in your lives? Practice loving kindness meditation, Emily has said. Intentional, right? Just doesn't happen. You have to make the time. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Deb. Anything else? Jana?
Where possible, I really try to avoid getting a response until I can calmly convince myself it's an appropriate response. If I can't, I do not need that.
Okay. Avoid giving a response until you're calm. Yeah. I find one of the most effective ways for me is to keep company with people who are striving like I am to live that way. Yeah, just to, we can remind each other, okay? Yes, Romeo. What do you say, Romeo? Indeed, indeed, yeah. Indeed. Yeah, and I mean, I like what was in the video, they said the most respectful thing that you can do with your poppy at the end of the season is to put it at the cenotaph, is that what you call it? Yeah? But what if, rather than discarding it, you know, we put it in a prominent place, you know, just to remind us daily that this is what we are called to be all about.